the whole narrative of the religious figures coming back is very hard for people to swallow. I think that, you know, I don't have any insight on what's going on, like where the information's coming from. Obviously, are other people that are active contacts. But I think a lot of people in the audience that only breeze through this quickly are having a hard time swallowing this. And I think it's due to the fact that it's obvious we've been programmed to giggle at any kind of extraterrestrial thing, any kind of ufology, the term UFO, that's why they renamed it UAP. We've been programmed across the board. The normal person has been programmed to giggle at it. And we've also been programmed to believe that we're the top of the food chain. And I know this isn't true. I know that there are many, many layers above us of advancement, of consciousness. There are beings that are more advanced mentally than we are. And so it's absolutely going to happen as disclosure happens, we're going to have beings that are godlike to us visit and that are connected to source. Like there is a level of consciousness that is connected to the creator of the entire universe. And it's hard for me to say it publicly because I'm not an active contact and I don't have this. This is just something kind of an inner knowing that it's all I've got. So I don't really spread this very often, but that's my take on it, is that there are beings that are connected directly to the creator of the universe and they work to that end. And disclosure includes them. And I've said it in many, many, many of my interviews that we lack examples to aspire to. People kind of don't aspire because we think that we're the smartest or we're the top of the food chain. This is it. And so people only aspire to get material things and not spiritual gain. And if we knew that there were beings that had highly advanced spirituality, that had highly advanced abilities because of the level of their consciousness, then we would aspire to be more like them. And we would let go of chasing after material things and we would chase after spiritual things. And so that's another reason that it's been suppressed. And so that's going to be part of disclosure. We're going to come in contact with beings that that ancient man would regard as gods and that actually are connected to a source god.
You're listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala, your source for the uncensored truth regarding the human, extraterrestrial, global, and political agenda. Click the like button and subscribe to this channel. And now, here's Dr. Michael Sala.
It's my great pleasure to welcome Tony Rodriguez back to Exopolitics Today. Welcome, Tony, back to the show.
Hi, Dr. Sala. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
For those that maybe don't remember your story, we first did a five-part series interview at Mount Shasta, I think it was in 2016. And we covered your story, your 20 year and back, where you were abducted as a child and put through roughly 5 years of various forms of exploitation on Earth in the Washington State area and in Peru before being taken to the moon and then to Mars and then to Ceres, where you spent quite a significant period of time working on a dark fleet ship. So that's for those that maybe don't know anything about your background. In terms of anything more, you know, for those that maybe don't know anything about you that you want to add to that?
Wow, you actually summed it up better than I ever did. And people always ask me to sum it up quickly, but that's kind of what happened. I was taken at the age of 10 in 1982, and then I was in black programs for 20 years. And then anymore, I don't even like to speculate on the technology, the cloning tech or time travel, whatever it was. But via technology, they put me back. And I was taken, I was taken on a Thursday night and I woke up Friday morning and I had lived 20 years. And I felt like I had been gone from home for 20 years and I had no memory of it, which seems to be a pretty common phenomenon, really. It's not like I was the only one. There are thousands of people that have come forward to say the same thing. But I'm different in the way that I remember a great deal of it. So that's the only thing that I would add, is that I'm not the only one.
Well, your book describes your experiences in those different facets after you were abducted at age 10 and taken into this program and used as a slave for 20 years and just kind of siphoned off the different programs. And one of the kind of major takeaways I thought that was very interesting was how you were the property of the Illuminati, that you said that there was this Illuminati family that was responsible for having you put into the program as a punishment for you just being kind of like a kid and insulting the child of one of these Illuminati types, and that they owned you and they could sell you off to different programs, whether it was a psychic drug running operation, whether it was a kind of sex trade, kind of like illicit use of children, or whether it was as a super soldier on the moon, on Mars, or then on Ceres, that you were owned at all times by the Illuminati. But then there was this requirement that you would be brought back. And you kind of like masterfully relate all of that in your book, Ceres Colony Cavalier, that came out. So I thought that was very important. And one of the things that I just want to acknowledge was how well you've been able to integrate all of these experiences and relate them to the audience in a coherent way, because it's very traumatic what you went through.
It seems like that is, you know, I believe that everybody has a unique gift. We see it all the time. People have unique gifts, and while I'm not very good at many things, it seems like long-term memory seems to be my particular gift. So I tend to remember things after years have passed with better detail than most people. Like even family members, when I look back at Christmas when we were kids, I have more detail and can see the picture in my head clearer than my brothers and sisters. So that was just my gift. And so as a result, after what I went through, I was able to give a more linear. There are other accounts. There's other people that I work with that have very compelling evidence. They've been through 20 and back situations, but they don't have the linear storyline. And so I thought that I would be one of very many that had that. And it turns out that because of a unique long-term memory gift that, you know, I have a linear story to my 20 years. I could put everything in order. And really, that derived from very early days of working with you, Dr. Sala, as you asked for a timeline before you even wanted to hear me out. You said, "Can you put it in a timeline, please?" Because I was really absolutely at the time just desperate for someone to hear me out. Because I had all these memories, and I couldn't process it all at the time. So when I put it in a timeline form, it actually enabled me to connect the dots and remember a great deal more.
Yes, I remember our first conversations and the importance of just kind of remembering it all in a coherent way, and that is very telling that you've been able to do this. So I want to raise some of the things that happened recently at the Galactic Spiritual Informers Connection in Orlando, Florida, that ran from October 21st to 23rd. It was the very largest conference I've been to for a number of years. Certainly in the US, in terms of contactees, there were over 950 participants. So it was a very major event. And you were one of the keynote speakers along with myself and a few others. And one of the people that was there was Jean-Charles Moyen, a French secret space program participant and a starseed. And he talked about his experiences and presented a lot of evidence. And you know, I've worked with Jean-Charles since I think 2019. And he is very credible and he has a lot of evidence to back up his claims. So he talked about his experiences, but what I thought was very interesting was that he recognized you, that your time on Ceres, he recognized you from his missions to Ceres, that he said that during his 20 and back, he performed missions to rescue children, people trapped on Ceres as slaves. And that's exactly what you were. You were on Ceres as a slave. And so he seemed to recognize you. So you want to talk about Jean-Charles and his recognition and your recognition and some of the other things that you told me before the interview began about a kind of white light and a tunnel.
So Jean-Charles recognized me first, and we talked. I actually met him on Zoom, and I've had him on my show. And, you know, he recognized me more, but it wasn't until I met him in person that, I will say this, and I say this quite often, is that the memory erasing process they put me through was very, very advanced. And I was able to defeat parts of it and not defeat parts of it. So faces and names, I don't remember. I just don't, from my time there. It's like when I see people, I remember them, but without their face, like a gray area. That part of the brain just didn't recover those memories. When I met Jean-Charles in person in Orlando for the first time, energetically, he felt very familiar to me and almost like we were related somehow. Like it was very, very strange. I don't want to say it like in a negative way. I'm not trying to put, but it was like, you know, meeting somebody that I've known for a very long time immediately. The other thing is, you know, over dinner, the closing night there, we all went to dinner and he had a piece of, you know, it was a stone, like a quartz, like a crystalline stone that he had in a little thing. And he said he brought that when he was teleporting as a child. He went to Antares, the Antares system, and he brought back a bottle of water. His father had asked him for proof, and he brought back a bottle of red water, and it had that stone in it. And he handed me this, I looked at it, and I said about the red water, and then it came back to me that when I was a very young child, I remember him visiting me. And the memories came back at then when I held the stone and I looked the red water and I went, oh my God. And I said, Jean-Charles, we need to talk. I don't want to do it now in dinner with everybody, but I really need to talk to you. And so after we got home a few days after the conference, we Zoom called and I told him, I said, look, I remember for a series of three or four nights spread out over a couple weeks, I believe, you know, over a piece of time that he visited me when I was a child. And I said, how old are you? When were you born? When was this going on? I need to know when, because it was before I went. I was 10 years old when I was taken into the programs. And he did the math. And I said, and he said, well, how old do you think you were? And I said, I don't know, 4, 5, 6, you know? And he said, well, I was 9 when I went and when he was born. So I would have been 6 years old. So that lined up. And then I said, look, I remember you coming to me while I was sleeping and saying, come on, Tony, you can go. And I was seeing a scene on the other end, and there was a long white tunnel with flashes of light, colored lights streaming up back and forth on it. And his face kind of got, you know, serious. And he went, oh my God, that's exactly what we were using on the Solaris. That's a technology. And he didn't really elaborate, but we both got goosebumps, that goosebump feeling. And I said, you came to me. And then later on, we did a round table the other night with all the speakers. We shared on Danny's channel, Danny Henderson recorded for, you know, kind of a follow-up. And after, you know, we're in the meeting with Alex Collier and Brad and Elena and everybody. And I said, you know, we were telling them about it. And I said, when I was young, I remember telling my mom about this, saying my friend, because I didn't have any friends. I lived kind of in the country. It was rural. And I said, I hope my friend visits me tonight. And she said, oh, that's cute. You've got an imaginary friend. What's his name? And I said, it's Charlie. And he's not imaginary. He's real. He comes to visit me and his name's Charlie. And we had the same experience because Charles said, nobody knows this, but when I was a child at that age, everybody called me Charlie. I went by the name of Charlie. And so that was another kind of, we both got goosebumps and, you know, pale white face and goosebumps because it seems somehow there was a connection between us for a very long time.
Well, that is very significant, because that happened before your abduction into the programs, and you knew Charles or Jean-Charles as a six-year-old, and that you and he were friends, and that to me tells me that you were probably taken through the portals that Jean-Charles reports being taken to Solaris, and where he met Maria Orsic and was exposed to various things. And he also talked about him being a starseed with a group of extraterrestrials. And he mentioned the name Victor, which apparently the correct spelling is actually Victor, that this is the same lineage as whether it's Valiant Thor or Thorhan or Regin, this is a group of extraterrestrials. So my guess would be that you were part of that kind of like starseed operation to incarnate on Earth and to do various things. Now, Jean Charles, he performed a mission as a person involved in the French secret space program, and that he would eventually start revealing that to the world. And it seems that you chose another mission, which was a very challenging mission, but it really switches things. Because when you mentioned this to me the first time, I thought, well, immediately, you know, my first impression was that you were a victim. You know, 2000, when you were 10 years old, what was it, 1982, you just were unfairly treated by this high-level member of the Illuminati who just took it out on you for kind of belittling or embarrassing his son. But given what you just shared, now it becomes clear that you were really part of a kind of galactic sting operation where you would do what you did so that the Illuminati would kind of like take you in punishment and do everything that they've done, you know, thinking that, well, at the end of the day, he's just going to be like all of these other people we take into the programs. His mind's going to be fractured. His emotions will be destroyed. He'll never amount to anything. He won't remember anything. So that, you know, that he'll just be kind of like achieve very little in life. And, you know, but in fact, you've done the opposite. You've gone through life as a very stable person. I know you have a family, two daughters, and you kept it all together, and now you're remembering everything and putting it all out. So that to me means that I don't think you were a victim. You were part of a kind of like a galactic sting operation. You want to comment on that?
I feel like I'm getting a reading, and it's very sobering to give that thought. And you know, because I've grown up with a certain identity, and I it's worth saying that I was a victim of it and to a certain extent, and I did have to process it, and I did go through a great deal of, you know, emotional carnage in the wake of what happened, and time that it met me. But where I'm at now and working with you and others and working with others, people that are coming, helping others that are going through the same kind of problems, you know, does shine light on the fact that I'm a witness to it. And I was built for a different purpose than just, like you said, to be swept into a victim. Like to a certain extent, I was built for this. And many things that have happened in my life, they got me to the point where I got the book, like getting the book done was very difficult. But I was the right people at the right time. I was visited, you know, in my house in the beginning, right when I was talking to you. There were things that, like, I'm not alone in this. And I believe that I'm not alone in my efforts that have gotten me to the point where I am. And so, yes, I'm going to have to unpack this, Dr. Sala, because this is, you know, you're laying this on me right now at this moment, so on camera, and I'm going to have to unpack this for a while before I can really sort it out. Like emotionally right now, I'm tied in a knot when you say that to me. And I realize, because this revelation with Jean Charles is recent. This is the other night, and it's very recent in me, and it's a very hard thing to swallow. And everybody, even Danny said, you know, I'm too humble. I need to kind of, it's a disservice to be humble and just keep telling everybody that you're lucky or whatever. And, but it's a different identity for me to be in a kind of different role than somebody that was just a witness. So.
It's really is amazing when we kind of look at the different roles we've played in this kind of like, you know, like Alex Collier estimates that there are 200 million star seeds that have incarnated on Earth. And we have multiple tasks, multiple missions, and they're all aimed at awakening people on the planet and gaining the planet's freedom from these oppressive extraterrestrial forces. And, you know, there are going to be those that are going to play the role of the double and the triple agents and, you know, be part of the infiltration, be part of the sting operations, and as well as those that play the role of the super soldier. And I just want to come back to, you know, this relationship you have with Jean Charles, because, you know, you were playing the role of this person that was going to be kind of like abducted and abused. But you're at all times connected to one of these, you know, you're a starseed, you're connected to one of these organizations and they're watching you. And we know now that Jean-Charles and you had some kind of a relationship at, when you were six. And Jean-Charles came to me in the conference and said, I know Tony, I know him. We did missions to Ceres to rescue people. And he says, I remember him from one of those missions. So that raises another intriguing possibility that on one of these rescue missions he did on Ceres Colony as part of these teams, that he recognized you, but somehow, you know, there was a connection made, but he maybe recognized that you know, you weren't, well, I don't know, I'll leave that to you, that there was a connection prior to that meeting on Ceres between you two guys. He saw you there as a slave. He rescued people, but somehow you were left there. And that kind of seems odd, but yet now it makes more sense if you were left there because you were part, you know, you were like a double agent.
It's a lot, like I said, it's still hard for me to unpack. I'll get in touch with him and go over the timeline aspect of that, because if he was there rescuing children, I was an adult basically when I was on Ceres. I was there from, I don't know, 18 till 30 years old is how old. So I was an adult while I was there. So there are definitely flashes of memories that are coming to mind right now. But I don't want to do it live on the air kind of thing. I really have to unpack. You're hitting, like I said, you're hitting me with a lot, Doc. And a bit of a loss for words when I think about it, when I look back on it. I always knew my whole life that I wasn't from around here. I always felt kind of not connected to a previous life on Earth kind of thing. Like I've always had a level of disorientation for this planet. And so I've always felt like when I hear the starseed thing, I always felt that was me, of course. And now when I look now, like as you're hitting me with this, I'm thinking of things, you know, my father was pronounced sterile by several doctors. And so when he met my mom, who already had four kids, it made sense for him. He was going to raise kids. And then they got married. And a year later, along came me. I was a miracle baby in that regard because he was medically pronounced sterile, that he would never have kids. And so, I totally feels like I got snuck in here into that role and in that. Sometimes I call it the wrong place at the wrong time, but maybe it was the right place at the right time because I've made something of it. And there are some other big projects in the works. I'll say this, I'll toot my horn. Because of the conference, I think that a lot of things in my life energetically really turned a corner. And I've had a lot of potential and opportunity shown to me now. There are some big projects in the works. So, I said it in the interview the other night. I felt like my whole life I was on the defense emotionally, and now I feel like I'm more on the offense after meeting everybody and going through what we went through over that weekend.
That is very revealing, and I look forward to kind of like hearing more about that. That you never told me about that incident with your father being sterile, and here you are, a miracle baby. And you know, that's part of the religious traditions, that, you know, there are these babies that are born because of extraterrestrial intervention. And to now hear that, you know, given what we've already discussed, it's like, okay, that's just another piece of the puzzle, which is now coming together. So yeah, look forward to that becoming clearer. Well, I want to talk now a little bit about the Farsight Institute. Because when your book came out in early 2022, the Farsight Institute's director, Courtney Brown, he read your book and he was intrigued. And so he thought he would investigate your claims. And he got a team of four remote viewers. He came up with two targets, and each target had different levels and objects and subjects in it. But essentially, he wanted to find out whether the things you had written about in your book were real, you know, because you talk about specific places that you were on, you know, Ceres and Mars. You talk about things that were happening, and he thought, well, these are good subjects for a remote viewing experiment. And it's worth pointing out that the Farsight Institute does blind protocols for its remote viewing. So that ensures that there's no front loading. So no one else in the of the four remote viewers that participated in this investigation knew anything about your book. I mean, maybe his son had read about it at some point, but they didn't know that the experiment was going to be on your book. So it was blind, and that prevents front loading, which is a problem. You know, there's a lot of people out there doing remote viewing, and you're remote viewing this and remote viewing that, but they don't do the blind protocol. And unfortunately, you know, that makes it a very subjective process and very unreliable, because it's very easy to front load because your subconscious is so powerful, which is why professional remote viewers, whether it's Joseph McMonagle, Courtney Brown, Russell Targ, well, that's an interesting name in your situation, given he taught you remote viewing. So these people have a scientific protocol that they investigate. So anyway, the bottom line is that he investigated your book, and the four remote viewers came up with data verifying your experiences. So you want to kind of comment about that?
Yes. So I was unaware of Farsight and what they had. Oh, am I still muted? Okay.
No, you're okay now.
I was unaware of the Farsight Institute and their work they had done until when it came out, everybody started messaging me and saying, you have to watch this. They've confirmed your story, Farsight. And I reached out to him, and I actually spoke with Dr. Courtney Brown a couple occasions on the phone. And once we talked for quite at length for quite some time, and he said that, you know, he's of the mind, he's one of those people that doesn't like to sit and watch a video, but he just doesn't like watching videos, but he can digest a book very quickly. So when my story came out in a book, he'd heard about it and read it. And he was fascinated by it, because he said that the data that he's gathered about how a certain ET species behave lined up with what he read in my book. He said it was uncanny. He said the things that you're saying about how the ET species behave, their personality, is exactly what we've gotten. He said it was uncanny. So he wanted to give it a further look. And he said that the accuracy of his remote view for most targets was actually also uncanny, that he had a much higher, I don't know how to say it, but point of accuracy on the remote views according to the book than he had had with other targets. And so he made it available to me, and I watched it, and it was a very, very good experience. The other thing was that he said that one of the remote viewers, and I don't want to mess up her name, Princess Janae, I don't want to mess it up, but at the very end, he said that she went into kind of almost like a trance-like state and said, you know, went in, was working on me at some point when they were trying to erase the memories, when they were putting in the memory block, and that she would put in I forget the term, he's got a term for it, where they remotely work on somebody, they remotely change something, and that she put in a form of protection that it would enable me to remember, to gain my memories. And he said she put it very, very deeply in my psyche while I was up there. That's because the remote viewing doesn't really necessarily, it's not at the same time. It doesn't obey time space. So they can remote view the past and future, so, and far away. So it was me while I was going to be having my memories erased. She put in a protection. So I don't know if that's the purpose. There seems to be a perfect storm of things in my instance that enabled me to get my memories back. There seems to be more than one factor. I deeply wanted my memories back. But that was all very, I don't want to say it was, surprising, but it was very humbling information for him to say, to get that kind of support. Of course, to me, it's my memories. I say it to people all the time. The book might seem like sci-fi to you, but it was my childhood. Those are my childhood memories. And So it's any kind of validation is very profound to me, like emotionally, very, very, very profound. It's a big moment. So when he did that, and I also have not really publicly went around, you know, bragging about it, the Farsight collaboration, because I think that people need to discover that on their own, you know. So that's why I haven't really said it in my, in a lot of my live talks or my presentations. I don't just whip out the Farsight, but it's very profound. And after I saw other work that they do, they're very, very adept at what they're doing at Farsight. Very good at it.
Indeed. Yes. I've looked at quite a number of the Farsight remote viewing experiments, and they're very thorough and they're very professional about what they're doing. And what you have in the Farsight, and I just kind of like want to just emphasize here that you've got four different remote viewers arriving at very similar conclusions about key experiences that you describe in the book, and they corroborated that. So what you have here is independent corroboration using a scientifically accepted protocol. And that is very important, because there are very few people within the contactee and the secret space program community who are putting out information that have that kind of corroboration. And I just wanted to kind of emphasize that, because I think it is very, very significant. Now, one of the things that I thought we should cover is that, you know, he did the remote viewing experiment and set it up that there were two targets. The first target was the interior of the asteroid, or of the kind of moonlet, whatever you want to call it, Ceres. And what they found was that there was a civilization under the ground. These were the four remote viewers, and that these were oppressive, that people were being exploited, and there were different extraterrestrial groups there and some humans there, and that it was a very oppressive environment, which is exactly what you described in your book. And that is powerful confirmation for what you describe in Ceres Colony Cavalier.
And it's worth of note, I would say, to take that even further, that the Ceres Colony Corp went through great lengths to alienate themselves from other colonies and from ET races, because they were oppressive and they knew exactly what they were doing. And they went through great other colonies, other space stations that were in our solar system, and actually out in between our solar system and other stars, there are space stations. They're far more inviting for guests than the Ceres Colony Corporation was. So they knew that they were committing crimes, and that they would regularly go into deep space and larceny and steal, and by all means necessary, gather technology and hide back in their planetoid where they were. So that was the culture and where they were at. So, you know, that being the example that a civilization that gets space flight isn't necessarily morally superior if they're technologically superior. A lot of people, I think, have that fallacy. They think that just because they have space flight that they're, you know, morally superior or advanced. And the Ceres Colony Corporation was definitely not. They were practicing slavery and many kinds of abuse.
I want to just read out the summary that Courtney Brown came up with when the remote viewers reported back about what they saw inside of Ceres and what you had said in your book. And this was his summary, quote, "Okay, so it seems like the asteroid or planetoid known as Ceres has quite a bit of hollowed out interior. There is a base on the inside. Moreover, it seems that there is some support for the memories of Tony Rodriguez that suggests that the base has a number of extraterrestrial species, and that the administration of the base is done by former Europeans, indeed former German Nazis," end quote. So that's corroboration for everything you wrote about the Ceres Colony in terms of how it was run in your book.
Yes. Recently somebody pointed out to me that I always said in my book that the Deutsch culture that took over, you know, they identified as Deutsch, not so much as Nazis. even though they were definitely structured that way. But on their money and in the artwork and slogans and things that were all over, they were very proud of the 1600s, the early 1600s. The 30 Years' War was from 1601 to 1630. And they taught a version of history that said that war was actually that their culture had defeated extraterrestrial and an extraterrestrial influence. Someone recently sent me like a TikTok click. And if you look back on the Nuremberg, the space battle, they have artwork and they said the space battle in Nuremberg, Germany, where all of a sudden cylinders and craft appeared and began to shoot at each other over the town. That was in 1577. So just 23 years prior to the 30 Years' War. So that was another corroboration that just popped up recently that I went, wow, you know, because they were very proud of it. And they were actually, horses were incorporated into their imagery because they had a slogan that said, "We did it with horses." In other words, that they defeated an advanced extraterrestrial influence, and they did it on horseback versus, that was one of their slogans. So, you know, I mean, that's a part of point of history. And that was kind of what the culture was like up there. Still very much almost like post-World War II Nazi culture, with the same kind of human rights and the same kind of, eugenics, the same kind of philosophies were up there in that. And many hollowed out caverns that had been converted into towns and connected by train. You could take a train everywhere there.
Well, the second target in the Far Side experiment was the incident. Well, let me read it out. Target two for the Far Side experiment was the interaction between the personality currently known as Tony Rodriguez and the bugs on Mars, as described on pages 185 to 193 in his book, Ceres Colony Cavalier. So the remote viewers focused on the incident that you describe in your book, where, you know, you were part of this kind of like auxiliary fighting force to entrap the insectoids on Mars in some kind of firefight that would then draw them out to be shot down by the regular Mars corporate military. So you want to explain that incident, what actually happened?
It's the most inconvenient part of my account, is the time on Mars. It's so distracting to so many people. And I was there for such a short time that, you know, it's hard to make sense of it all. But basically, the insectoids could reproduce faster than we could put soldiers there. So there was an ongoing conflict that I don't really know the history of. And the insectoids could just put numbers out. And in an effort to match that, they took people like me. I was not groomed for anything. That I was taken, like you said, because I out of punishment. So I wasn't somebody that was groomed to be, you know, at a young age to be genetically modified to be an optimal soldier. I was just a bot, you know, slave labor. So they were taking people that were of the labor class and trying to equip them and train them as minimally as possible so that they could generate great numbers for the battlefield. And we were the test for that. We were the test bed, the prototype for that project, which failed and they canceled. But with the details of what happened in that combat, we went on hiking missions with, you know, two real soldiers that had armor, and we were in bright white environmental suits, and we would go hike and be basically essentially bait for insectoids to engage us, and then the other soldiers would engage them from afar. And a couple times there was combat, we never saw. I hiked from A to B and didn't know what happened, and it was a success. But we were engaged, and I watched the Far Sight film on it, you know, the video on that, and I'm not sure exactly how much detail they got from that. But yeah, we were engaged and we were in combat, and I did interact with one of the insectoids, which to me seemed like somebody that was very smart. It was a very professionally behaved being and very smart. It was a very smart being. It wasn't Some of them seemed like, some of the insectoids behaved and communicated like an animal, but this one was very, very intelligent, very articulate, and very professional, even though I was in an enemy combatant that had been captured by it.
Yeah, you want to comment about that, because, you know, given what we discussed earlier, now that we recognize that you were more than just a victim and accidentally caught up in this, that you may have been a deliberate plant, you know, let's kind of look at what that bug saw inside of you. Because, I mean, he gave permission for you to be released. I mean, rather than you being killed, which would have been the logical outcome, he said, no, he recognized something in you and said, no, this one we're going to let live. So you want to elaborate on that?
I was wounded in combat. The two other men that were support soldiers like myself were murdered or put to death by the insects. And it came up and interacted with me psychically. It put me in a dream state with it, where I could no longer feel the pain of my injuries. And it was scanning my life. It was looking through my memories like a Rolodex in my life. And it was communicating to something else. It was narrating what it saw to something else that I didn't see or hear, like another intelligence. So I can only imagine like a hive mind, you know, like a hive type hierarchy. But I begged it for my life, and shamelessly, I would say anybody that's ever been in that situation, there is no shame in that. It looks like something shameful in the movies, but it's not. To be in that situation and beg for your life is a very honorable thing, having done it. But I begged for my life, please don't kill me, please don't kill me, I don't want to die. And it was, like I said, very professional the way it interacted. Said, I don't want to kill you, but you know, if I'm ordered to, I will. And well, let's see. And then it scanned and went through my, and it seemed like the goal of the scan was to look for my purpose in life. If I was, you know, some people, their purpose in life is to be a soldier and is to be in combat. Mine wasn't. And it said my purpose ultimately was to be loving, to for love. And it let me go. And I woke up and the pain came back, and the bug that was holding me dropped me on the spot. And they immediately retreated. They took off and left me there. And two soldiers came and rescued me and carried me back to base. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think that's good. I mean, I was wondering whether the bug recognized some other quality within you. But what you described is, I think, sufficient itself, that it recognized that, you know, that your purpose was something different to just being a soldier and fighting and destroying enemies. That there was, that love was really your deep purpose, your soul mission, and that it was kind of acknowledging that, you know, that was something that it honored and let you go. That
it was assessing if I was going to be a future threat. So if I was meant to be a soldier, if my life's purpose was to be a soldier, and they let me go, that I would just come back and keep fighting, then I think it would have killed me on the spot. But I think that's what it was assessing, you know, my threat level to the collective of them. That's my best guess, at least.
And as I recall, in the Farsight Institute, I mean, they, when they did the remote viewing, you know, they kind of like picked up on something like that, where one of the bugs or the insectoids kind of like had mercy. Am I correct? Did they kind of do that in the remote viewing? They picked up on that?
I believe so. I'm not sure exactly how it came out. Like, I when I watched the Farsight thing, I did it over, because I'm the same way about watching videos. I can't sit for 2 hours straight and just watch a video. So I watch them 15 minutes at a time over the course of a couple weeks, and that's kind of how I did. So I'm pretty sure that's what they said. There were a few different versions of that instance that the remote viewers had come up with, you know, their testimonies.
Right. And you already kind of mentioned this incident where one of the remote viewers, Princess Janie, says that she implanted a compulsion in you or something that would trigger your recollection of what happens. And this was something I remember first hearing from Randy Kramer back in 2014, when we talked, we did our first interview, and he said that those individuals that are more empathic, that they have this kind of like ability to retrieve their memories, because their memories are not stored just in the subconscious. They're stored in the superconscious, or, you know, you might call it the Akashic record. And people who are empathic, or have, like in your case, they have a deeper soul purpose or a mission, you know, you, even though their surface memories can be wiped, the memories from the superconscious can come back. I mean, that they're all stored up there and they come back. And so he said that this typically is what happens with intuitives. And so in your case, it would seem to me that, you know, whether it was Princess Janie laying a kind of a compulsion in you, in your subconscious, that would one day be triggered and you would have full recollection or total recall, or whether it was just the fact that, you know, you do have this kind of loving purpose and you're more connected to your soul, and you would have remembered anyway. But, you know, the fact is that you do remember a lot of this and are now talking about it.
And like, I, you know, when I look back on it, like I can't put my finger on one specific instance that gave me my memories back. I got an MRI scan 2 weeks before the main memory event. There were several, they knew that I was going to remember during the process of putting me back. I cover that in the end of my book too, is that they had a chronovisor. So they were looking at probable futures, and they kept coming up with there was a threshold of above 30% or something that I would get my memories back. And they kept trying to reprogram me and try different methods of making me forget and bring that probability down. And they never did. And so because I had my record deleted for, like I said, it's a perfect storm of events, chain of events that let me come back with, because they were going to just lobotomize me and put me back as a cripple. They were as somebody that was mentally crippled. I was to wake up the next morning and not have the ability to articulate. They were going to cripple me. And when they took me to the window to do that on the moon base, on the trapezoid base, they took me there. They said his records isn't here. So my captain at some point deleted my record, which is a very big crime in that in the Ceres colony. But that they said that if there's no record, then it doesn't matter if he remembers, because it won't, there's no proof on the other end. And it's just put it back. And the reptilian that had been my escort, was my security escort, said, "Oh, well, this is your lucky day." And he walked me back to the process and put me back. And then that was the last thing I remember before I woke up in my bed the next morning. That was literally the last memory. Was the, "This is your lucky day." He was walking me to a surgical unit in the building to have basically a lobotomy. They were going to lobotomize me because they never got me under a safe threshold to where my memory blanking would have taken. And they knew that. They were looking at probable futures, and they knew that. And during that time, I think, is when that process is when Princess Janine, I think that's when she showed up. It was during that process, that the very final throw, because it went back to a trauma-based experience. They were shocking me, and there was actually like a Zoom call with one of the Draco, one of the beings. And the experience that I did was another overlap with Jason Rice. Jason Rice described basically the same. They showed me flashes of people being slaughtered before I spoke to it. It wanted me in a state of shock before it spoke to me. And that was all. Hope I'm not being confusing here. Sorry, guys, to everybody, if I'm rambling. But there seems, like I said, there seems to be a perfect storm of events that enabled me to have which is why I personally believe that I wasn't alone, that it wasn't, that there were, I believe there are external forces that have enabled me to get as far as I have.
Yeah, let's kind of like dive a little deeper into that. So we're talking 2002. You've been brought back from Ceres. You're now on Lunar Operations Command or on that trapezoid base there on the moon, and you're being processed to be returned back to 20 years in the past, 1982, as a 10-year-old. And so your memories were wiped, but this kind of lobotomy was going to be performed. And I just want to kind of like go a little deeper into that, because I know in the past we've described, you described how in 1982, when you were taken into the program for the first time, that your consciousness was transferred into a clone. And so your clone was then taken out and all these things happened. So your original body, I assume, was back in 1982 and kind of like just being held in stasis by those grays that abducted you, because for them it would just be, you know, just a few moments or a few hours before your consciousness is come back. So really, so from 2002 to 1982, it's like somehow your consciousness was put back in time, but yet the memories associated with your consciousness weren't fully purged in the way they were supposed to be.
So during that process, when they went through the, I was back in my 10-year-old body. So there was a point where I woke up back in my 10-year-old body and I did not have the memories of the time and space, the 20 years in space. So, but they do a final check. And at that point, so this must have been back in 82, like after the time travel, I was on the base, the trapezoid base on the back of the moon in 1982, after it was over. This was the return. And at that time, they were looking, they had chronovisor technology. This is what I'm getting the term chronovisor from Dr. Bashago. Bashago, Andy, the Pegasus. I'm saying his name wrong. Sorry. But I think it's Bashago. Am I saying that
Andy
right?
Bashago.
Bashago, yeah. So he came up with the term chronovisor. I spoke with him on the phone once, and we kind of, you know, he asked me some questions about what I had witnessed about it, and he concurred that he had seen the same device. Basically, there was a being in the room that was looking on a screen, and they were ribbing me about my memories because I was combative about the whole thing, and I was back in it. I, you know, was in a room full of ETs, maybe 8 or 10. Grays, reptilians, and one tall one, which tall white-ish one, that was licensed to look at the chronovisor, and they were ribbing me about it. And I said, I am going to remember. And I got livid. And he said, guys, stop. You know, they all got in trouble. He made it, knock it off. And they said he is starting to remember. Like, it changed the timeline. He was looking at probable time. He wasn't looking directly at the future. He was looking at probable timelines. Like, there was a number, you know, out of 1,000 timelines, that there were 600 of them that I remembered. And he had to get that number down. He said, you guys, and then that's when they basically got me dressed and put me in another part of the building. And I went through another round of, you know, the memory deleting process happened in the adult body. They began that process while, as I was still in the adult body, and put me through that process. And then when I was back in my original body, I was supposed to have all the memories gone, which I did, but they saw that I was going to remember. Like, the probability of a relapse of the memory was high. And that's when they began. So this must have been back in 82. It's funny, I haven't talked to anybody about this scene since I wrote the book. Really, I never get asked much about this. The other thing was that was also the time, and I always am careful to tread along a religious line, but in that moment when they said, do you get your memories back, you know, do you remember anything, and I said, yeah, I was in my house yesterday, and they laughed at me. And I, the only thing my mother had taught me only weeks prior, that it, you know, my mother was very Christian woman, and she said, if you believe it enough and you ask Jesus for it, he'll give you anything. And I said, in the name of Jesus, I'll remember. I was livid. And it was at that moment that the being looking at the chronovisor said, guys, knock it off, now he remembers. Like, it was at that moment that it diverted. So there was power in that, whether either the raw belief of it, whether Jesus himself did something, whether it's a religious thing, I don't know. I don't want to make a statement about that. I believe in a creator God and all that, but I don't want to alienate people. But that was exactly what happened. I said, in the name of Jesus, I will remember. And it was at that moment that the probabilities changed. And then I had to go into another round of trauma-based mind control to make me not remember as a child, as a 10-year-old on the moon. And I know it was the moon because the office they took me to was a corner office and it had windows. And I was actually could look out on and see the lunar surface, which was dark. They said the sun was still quite some hours before it. The sun did come up, but it would be a long time and I wasn't going to see it. There was another one of the, another gray being there that was putting me through that, that round. And then that's when that Zoom call, I call it a Zoom call, but basically a conference call with probably a Draco happened.
That's very telling that kind of religious belief system in Jesus actually played a role in you being able to remember things, or definitely affected the timeline. So I want to kind of bring this conversation to the here and now, because a lot of this happened like 40 years ago. Now here we are, 2022, we seem to be at a kind of like turning point for humanity, and there's a lot of data showing a lot of prophecy is manifesting, and there's a lot of people talking about the second coming, whether it's the second coming of Jesus, whether it's the return of the gods of Quetzalcoatl and Kukulkan, whether it's the return of the Anunnaki, Enki, and all of that. There seems to be a perfect storm of these religious motives that are starting to appear in the extraterrestrial contact and secret space program literature. So anything you want to kind of add to that?
I think that the whole narrative of the religious figures coming back is very hard for people to swallow. I think that, I don't have any insight on what's going on, like where the information's coming from. Obviously, are other people that are active contacts. But I think a lot of people in the audience that only breeze through this quickly are having a hard time swallowing this. And I think it's due to the fact that it's obvious we've been programmed to giggle at any kind of extraterrestrial thing, any kind of ufology, the term UFO, that's why they renamed it UAP. We've been programmed across the board. The normal person has been programmed to giggle at it. And we've also been programmed to believe that we're the top of the food chain. And I know this isn't true. I know that there are many, many layers above us of advancement, of consciousness. There are beings that are more advanced mentally than we are. And so it's absolutely going to happen when, as disclosure happens, we're going to have beings that are godlike to us visit and that are connected to source. Like there is a level of consciousness that is connected to the creator of the entire universe. And it's hard for me to say it publicly because I'm not an active contact, and I don't have this. This is just something kind of an inner knowing that it's all I've got. So I don't really spread this very often, but that's my take on it, is that there are beings that are connected directly to the creator of the universe, and they work to that end. And disclosure includes them. And I've said it in many, many, many of my interviews that we lack examples to aspire to. People kind of don't aspire because we think that we're the smartest or we're the top of the food chain. This is it. And so people only aspire to get material things and not spiritual gain. And if we knew that there were beings that had highly advanced spirituality, that had highly advanced abilities because of the level of their consciousness, then we would aspire to be more like them. And we would let go of chasing after material things, and we would chase after spiritual things. And so that's another reason that it's been suppressed. And so that's going to be part of disclosure. We're going to come in contact with beings that that ancient man would regard as gods, and that actually are connected to a source god. So I feel like I'm walking through a minefield here, but that's all I got. So I don't have a lot of pertinent information for that, and I feel like time will tell. It's been my experience when I first came public that you know, I got a lot of flack. I came under fire for my information, and a lot of people, you know, immediately dismissed my story. But as time has gone on, I've only been defended and validated. Oh, and it just takes time. And where we're at right now is going to be no different. So these revelations of the giants and of the arcs and the things that have been coming to light, time is going to tell. So nobody's going to sort this out overnight, but you know, time will sort this out. We've also got other people that are telling us things that are complete BS that are out there, and time will sort them out too. So time is the greatest lie detector. And in my case, it's been very validating.
Well said. So this second book that you're working on, any kind of teasers as to what you're going to be covering in that?
Wow. So, you know, I got asked after the first book, I had two questions that hundreds of people reached out with. Who was the kid on the moon that you kicked? There was a black kid that I met on the moon base that he was a child and I kicked him. He came running at me to hug me, and everybody, who's he? And where is he now? So that's a big question. And then what happened when you were taken again for the 10 years? So they sold us off. They sold our consciousness off to a species for 10 years. And because I don't have proof of it, and because it was it's very complicated to talk about time travel for people. So it's something that I left out of all of my interviews. And, you know, it's something that I made note of and I mentioned, but I kind of left out. So the second book is basically those 10 years. And what I'm finding is, because I'm doing, you know, you research it, you know, there's a timeline there, and the memories are more vague. They're not as clear, but there are very clear memories of what happened. And what I'm starting to realize is that instance at the end of it may be the key to the entire thing, to the entire 20 years. Is another, and I'm saving it, there's a reveal at the end, because I think it's going to call into question what a lot of people think about themselves, what we really are, what our consciousness really is. I'm going to raise some questions about that by what I experienced during those 10 years, at the end of those 10 years. And so I'm just going to cover that. And it turns out, I always said that this book would be my second book would be the companion to the series Colony Cavalier. But as I'm getting into it, it may be the other way around. I think that this is the main book, the main reason that it may be the main reason that I have my memories back.
So, any idea when you'll finish that book?
Due date is April. So when I look back on it, I think that I was taken on April 7th, 1982. I could be wrong there, but that's kind of what, because it's something that I think about quite a bit, actually. So April 7th, 1982, I think, was the day I was taken. But so I'm shooting to release the book on April 7th, 2023. So this April. And then I have a few conferences scheduled after that. It seems I've been flooded with speaking engagements for this year. I'll be doing a lot of traveling. And so I want to get that book out right in the beginning of April. And it's on track. And oddly enough, more of the same experiences happened. People are very qualified, very talented people are volunteering to help me get the book out. And it's been like I said, it's been like that all along. It's because it's something that I couldn't do on my own. And so I feel very blessed with the people that are coming forward to give me a helping hand on this book, you know, for artwork and editing and just across the board. So it's coming together. So far, so good.
So where do people go, Tony, to get more information about you, if they want to buy your book, if they want to get in touch with you? I know you do sessions.
I've done sessions with people that feel like they've been through the same thing. I kind of sort it out as best I can. And I have a method of helping people kind of uncover more memories without being hypnotized. I'm a fan of hypnosis, but I think it should be saved for the last bit, last resort. And I do sessions with people to try to kind of just make sense. A lot of people just have fragmented memories they can't make sense of. And I just kind of iron them out in a way. So, and then the book link and all that, and my show Talks with Tony is on Patreon. It's all from, you can find it all at tonyrodriguez.com, spelled the same way with an S, R-O-D-R-I-G-U-E-S, tonyrodriguez.com. And I haven't revamped the site in a long time, but it's got links to our original ExoPolitics links are on there to watch the very first interviews I did. You can see, you know, there was the same story 6 years ago than it is now. I've remembered more since then. Details have filled, but there's free interviews there. There's links to my Patreon channel. There's links to the memory course. And you can email me through there. And there's a link to buy the book on Amazon.
Well, thank you, Tony, for your courage in coming forward, revealing the incredible information, also covering the very disturbing aspects of what you've been through, and, you know, just being willing to, you know, step out there and be part of the disclosure process. And I know your testimony is having a great impact. You're awakening a lot of people, and, you know, congratulations for that.
Thank you. I think it's very important. All along, I've been a big believer in the mission of disclosure. I think people need to know. The more that people know is better than less. And even the negative aspects of it, people need to know that these happen, and people have had these things happen to them, and they can't confront them until they know they've happened. They know they're possible. So when they see my testimony and the negativity that I experienced, they go, wow, I think that is what happened. And then that's the first step to healing it. That's the first step to getting over it, is just being able to talk about it and accepting it. So we need to know that these things happened, that mankind is capable of very brutal things. And it's an important thing. And I believe very strongly in the mission.
You have been listening to ExoPolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala. Please remember to like, share, and subscribe to this channel. Join or start a conversation in the comments. Take the time to explore the vast library of best-selling books, webinars, and podcasts by Dr. Sala. Visit exopoliticstoday.com.